Clemens rector eterne.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 25 of This Turbulent Priest, a podcast hosted by me, Father Ed Tomlinson, a Catholic priest of the Ordinariate of Our Lady of Walsingham, based in the parish of St Anselm's in Pembury, UK. This week, I'm going to talk to one of the young adults in our congregation. Like most churches, we have an abundance of young children, older folk, middle-aged people, but the missing generation are those aged between about 18 and 30. It's quite a common thing that at this point in life, people have gone off, are exploring things, and often come back to church when they themselves have children. But we do have a few in our congregation, and we cherish them. And one of them is James Shaghagi. He has come to us all the way from Holy Trinity Brompton, a charismatic evangelical church in the heart of London, and came to Catholicism from there via a route into Pentecostalism. So his journey is certainly interesting. And I caught up with him, wanting to know how and why he'd ended up here worshipping with us. He's a charming young man, and I do hope you enjoy all he has to share. I'm in St Anselm's Pembury. We've just finished the celebration of Mass today, and one member of our congregation, James Shaghagi, has kindly remained behind to be the guest on this week's podcast. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Father.
James, tell us a little bit about who you are, because you're not that old, actually, so an autobiography won't take us too long. Talk to us.
No, so I'm 25 years of age, as my grandfather would say it. And, so I was born in Chelsea, in London, and grew up in Wandsworth until I was six.
Okay.
With my three siblings, and then the parents decided to move to Kent.
And came to Kent. So you're one of four children then.
I'm one of four.
And
now.
What number are you? People put stock in this.
I'm the eldest.
Ah, the one who's responsible.
Yep,
does all the hard work.
Yes, and gets it in the neck when you're kind of told to kind of get your siblings in order.
Lovely. And what did Dad do? Mum do? What?
So my mum's a teacher,
mm-hmm.
and my father's also a teacher.
Yeah.
So it's but primary and secondary. So mm-hmm. they kind of do very different things. So she teaches perception, and
yep.
he teaches chemistry. So he's blowing things up.
Oh gosh, yes, I was always terrible at chemistry, but yeah, good for him. So a modern day Walter White,
absolutely.
And okay, so the family come to Kent,
yep.
and where do they settle?
So we settled in a small village outside of Tunbridge Wells called Groombridge,
mm-hmm.
and we were there for quite a few years actually. And then since then, we've kind of moved between Tunbridge and Groombridge.
Okay.
But now we're kind of in Tunbridge,
mm-hmm.
and have been for the last 3 years.
And just for listeners who may not realise, rather confusingly, there are two towns either side of Pembury. There's Tunbridge Wells with a U and Tunbridge with an O. They're different places. I think it was designed to confuse any visitor.
Mm.
My mother still calls Tunbridge Wells Tunbridge. You know, you can get very confused on it. So you're over in Tunbridge.
Yes.
And that's still the family home.
That's the family home.
And where did you go to school, James? So you were in Wandsworth until what age?
Until six. So I went mm-hmm. to a school called Dolphin.
Yep.
Which is a Christian school. I think it's still there.
Yes.
And then when we left Kent, I was left for Kent, mm-hmm. I went to a village primary school, St Thomas's in Groombridge.
Okay, yeah.
So very kind of Church of England.
Yeah, little village school.
Absolutely.
Lovely.
And then after that, I went to the Judd School.
To the Judd School, which is a grammar school.
It's a grammar school. It does very well mm-hmm. academically, and is a kind of big rugby school as well. So I got stuck into kind of both strands of their kind of strength there.
Fabulous. Yes. No. My
step-grandfather went to Jard and my grandfather went to Skinner's. So there's a great rivalry there, even over a woman, it would seem. Wonderful. And Jard was a good experience for you?
Jard was a very good experience. I think if you want to be successful at Jard, you've either got to be academic or good at rugby. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. I was good at both. So I thrived there. Mm-hmm. I think it does give you that rigorous academic education that I think, you know, is lacking in some schools. I think
sadly.
It designs to, I think, inspire you and take you higher and get you to question things, which is really helpful.
And again, for listeners who maybe don't know the area very well, Kent is one of only a few counties left in England that maintain a grammar school system. Mm. So at the end of primary school, children sit an exam, and if they get high enough grades, they can go to the kind of streamed grammar school. So there's a greater emphasis on academia, and children are stretched, and really they are very good schools and very desirable, but often very difficult to get into.
Yes.
Great. And so rugby, did you carry on that just at school, or did you a bit of club rugby?
So I played club rugby as well. So I played for Tunbridge Juddians.
Boo.
Yeah, and I was, Father Ed's a Tunbridge Wells man.
Yeah.
And
I did play a season for Tunbridge Juddians, actually. I played for their twos when I first came here, but I keep that quiet. I then went over to Tunbridge Wells.
But no, it was a good time. I think that's where I kind of really flourished in my rugby. But I was in the top team all the way through.
Excellent.
Both at Jardand and TJ's.
Second row. I could guess.
Absolutely.
He's a tall lad.
But I kind of, my last season, I did actually shift to the wing, which was really interesting. I discovered I was actually quite quick. And we had our back three were all over 6 foot and very quick. And so it was a kind of dangerous kind of weapon.
But nothing happens out there. How very boring for you.
Oh, yes.
Stay in the pack. Anyway, this isn't a rugby podcast. It's very much a church one. So, James, you then go off to university?
I go off to university, so I went off to read law at Durham. Okay. I was fortunate enough
Which college were you at?
University College, so Castle. So, I mean, I actually lived in there. So I think buildings that inspire, I think do affect your academics.
Oh, no
question. They make you want to be there, and there's the history of that.
Beauty is very important, and you look at modern town centres compared to what we used to build. It's also depressing, and I'm not surprised people get depressed.
Mm.
So I think you're right. Wonderful surrounds bring out the best in us. So you're at Castle, you're studying law, and so with the intention of becoming
a lawyer.
A lawyer. There you are. Makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. And so where are you now in that?
So I'm currently studying the legal practice course, which for those of you who don't know is. Essentially, it's the kind of 1 year course that you have to do before you do your kind of articles that they used to be called.
Yeah.
Which is essentially a 2 year apprenticeship, if you like, under some lawyers, and then eventually you become qualified, and then you can do it yourself.
Wow! And so, a couple of years away from being able to make some money.
Yes, absolutely.
And even then, not necessarily too much at the beginning, but
yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, great. And so, do you hope to stay around here to do that? Or?
Oh, yeah, I do, because my training contract is with a firm called Cripps
in Tunbridge Wells. I know it.
And that's a wonderful, wonderful firm. It's a kind of very much like a London type firm, but they have a London office, but they're in Tunbridge Wells as their main office. So, I think for me that's exciting, because I think I want to be the kind of father in particular who can actually, you know, be at home for tea.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, indeed. I think with a lot of your generation are starting to say, hang on, you know, just giving your entire life to work seems a little bit, the balance isn't there. So I think you're very wise to do that. I've always preferred towns to cities, but that's just me. James, let's now talk about faith. When did it come into your life? How did it progress? Because you've been on quite a journey, really, and one quite similar to me.
So I was very fortunate to be born into a Christian family, a kind of Anglican family. And so from a young age, prayer was central to everything we did. And
so did you pray with mum and dad at home?
Prayed with mum and dad at home. I think what's amazing is my mother kept a diary of all the answers to prayer from a young age that I prayed.
What a lovely idea.
Yes. And so I can look back now, even though I can't remember. And there's an amazing story of a time when I was struggling with nightmares, age three. And one day, I told my parents, this little girl came to me last night. Her name was Sophie. And after that, the nightmares stopped. And so my parents thought that was an angel, my kind of guardian angel, bringing me a message of comfort from God. But I was doing some reading yesterday and I realised that Sophie is a corruption of the Greek name Sophia, which was one of the names of Our Lady.
Oh, wow.
And so I don't know.
Who knows, yes.
But I think that, if it is that, that would explain why even before I was Catholic, I did have this great love for Mary that I didn't understand.
Right, so you've always had a Marian devotion, that just not quite sure why. Where were you worshipping at this time when you were a child?
So I was at HTB, which is a kind of short.
So you used to go into London still?
So we would go into London even after we left.
Mm-hmm. I interrupted you. To HTB, which stands for Holy Trinity Brompton.
Yes.
People probably have heard of it because of the Alpha Course, which came out of that church via an old Etonian, Nicky Gumbel, who famously, and Sandy Miller, who were the clergy there. Describe what Holy Trinity Brompton is, what tradition it's in, and for our Catholic listeners who may not understand the Church of England, maybe just fill things out a bit.
So HDB is very much an evangelical church, but particularly kind of charismatic.
Yeah.
So there's less emphasis on liturgy, very kind of no real understanding of the Eucharist at all.
No. I've always said with evangelicalism, I mean, it's really a very Protestant form of worship.
Yes.
It would be definitely derive its roots not from the Via Media of the Anglican Middle or the Old High Church. This is the Low Church. These are people who are very strong on sola scripture, on God's holy word being our guide for life, and as you say, on prayers and the Holy Spirit. In my experience, these are people who have enormous sincerity and integrity. Their love of God is real. Unlike the lazy liberals in the middle, these are people who genuinely try and say the creed and mean it. I think, as you say, there are big gaps. That's the problem, that there's no sacramental understanding, really none at all. I think their ecclesiology is very weak and thin, but very good in terms of evangelization, of bringing people to faith in Christ, and of helping people have... You know, if Catholics sometimes are over-catechized but not evangelized enough, these are the other way around. They're often not catechized enough, but my goodness, they evangelize. They really help people having a living relationship with Jesus Christ, and that's not something to be dismissed. I think on that, they are absolutely brilliant.
Yes, and I would just add that I think because of that sincerity, I think I'm very grateful for that formation. Because I was taught that we could know God personally.
Yes.
And I'm particularly grateful for, at least at the time, HTB was very, very conservative, particularly under Sandy Miller.
Yes.
And so I had a very good moral formation.
Mm-hmm. And evangelicals have always definitely taught well the need to stand apart from the world in terms of living a different standard, that Christians are called to a certain way of life. And again, you know, on that, they're to be commended.
Absolutely. And I think one of my earliest memories at HTB is that of my mother saying, James, you have to, age five, saying you have to take off your cap because Sandy Miller doesn't like men wearing hats in church. And absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, I'm very grateful for kind of little things like that. But I think having grown up with Anglo-Catholic grandparents... And I'd go and
so
stay.
Here's another strand of influence.
Yes. And so I'd go and stay every summer and every holiday, actually, with them.
Mm-hmm. Where were they based?
So they were based in Warwickshire, in a little village of Harbury. It had a lovely. It has a lovely Norman church.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was the sacristan there. So I would be taken round by him and my grandmother.
And shown a different side of
shown
things.
Shown a different side of things, shown the sanctuary, shown an altar. Mm-hmm. And from my evangelical perspective, I didn't get it, but I knew it was important. And it's stuck in, as a young child, it's stuck in my mind.
So you sense there's something here, but I don't quite have the language to unpack it.
Yes, and I wanted it to be true.
That's fascinating. And I think I can relate to that, because I was also raised as an evangelical and went to a big evangelical youth group and church. And I also would go into other churches and discern. This is very different. It's like another language. But I don't know about you, but I used to discern there was a... I think I used to feel the presence, actually, of the sacramental. Mm. And that there was something maybe missing, you know. Mm. So it's interesting that you have that.
Absolutely. And I think going to a Church of England primary school as well, and having the church very nearby and seeing the altar rail, there was that side of things as well. I knew that there was something more.
And how old are you at this time? Is this during sort of school days?
Yeah, so primary school, so kind of 9, 10, yeah. 11. But yes, and then as I went to Judd, that kind of shifted. I was beyond the kind of times of kind of being shown around the church by my grandparents.
I think, you see, I'm always interested at the moment about what it's like being a Christian in a school in modern England, because, you know, it's changed so much. You know, when I was young, there was still just about Christian content in school, but there was certainly an understanding that we are a Christian country and that the Christian faith needs to be respected, if ignored a bit by my time. This was the 70s, you know, it was all unravelling, and the 80s. But today, I mean, you just look at school curriculums and all of that has gone. And in fact, there's quite a hostility to the faith often. You know, we have a curriculum now that gives you Gay Month, Gay History Month, Black Awareness Month. Yeah. It's a new religion being preached. And the old one really doesn't have any sort of hold at all. So what was it like going to Judd with a Christian faith in a culture that really is no longer Christian?
So I would say I was very lucky, because the headmaster at the time was Robert Masters, who was a very kind of devout Christian.
Right.
And he would read scripture to us.
Fabulous.
And he would sometimes his assemblies would even turn into kind of semi-sermons. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing is, he was one of those headmasters who actually enforce the law.
And carried on doing what he should have been doing,
Exactly. The law is, as far as I'm aware, it was at the time at least, that an act of Christian worship should occur in every school.
And so what sort of year would this be?
So this was... I started Judd in 2009.
Wow, so really not very long ago. Yeah.
And then left in 2016.
That feels like yesterday to me. You are young, aren't you?
Yes, I am indeed. And he was there all the way through. So I was very lucky. But in terms of the boys, I mean, I think at the time there was a little bit of hostility, but more of a kind of, you're wrong. And so I ran the Christian Union from year 9 up until year 13.
Yeah. How many did you used to get to that?
Well, initially it was quite small, but towards the end it was like about 30 people.
Oh, good. Man. You're obviously a missionary. You're not going to be a lawyer, you'll be a priest. Keep going, yeah.
So that was fantastic. And I think towards the end of Judd, I think more of a secular agenda was starting to be
was then coming in. I think it is in recent years it's suddenly escalated. But I mean, there will be people like your wonderful headmaster, if he's listening, God bless you for keeping going, because so many other schools now, I mean, it's just, it frightens me, but there we are. But I am fascinated in what it's like for our Christian youth at the moment is a really interesting question. So that's great. So you're at school, you're running the Christian Union. What did you used to do as a Christian Union? Because obviously you're not a sacramental presence.
No. So I think initially we had a lot of support from the kind of youth pastor at St. Stephen's.
Okay, big evangelical church in Tunbridge, yeah.
So, yeah, we did Bible readings. We also, you know, we did a lot of, this is very evangelical, for a lot of thematic teaching. Yeah. And so we would talk about...
A season on Titus.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Things, things like that. But then
I remember.
But then the youth pastor changed. Mm-hmm. And he was very, he was a lot more charismatic.
Okay.
And what we, I think this is what why the CU grew, isn't the Christian Union. It grew because we started to actually pray for one another.
That's fascinating, yeah.
And
you actually let the Spirit in.
Yes, and that people were drawn to that. People who weren't Christians, or at least from nominal Christian families, they were attracted by that genuineness.
Mm. I think that's fantastic, and I think it's something we're not very good at as a nationality, really. I think the English are so reserved, aren't we, that just sort of open prayer and charismatic prayer, doesn't come naturally to an Englishman, but sometimes it's exactly what we need. I always think the danger with charismaticism is that it can be too much based on heart and not enough head, that it can be chasing a sensation, a feeling, rather than something concrete. But I wouldn't dismiss it at all. That's not to be, you know, because I think it has its place. What I'm saying is I think it's actually a great tool of the church, one of the greatest, but it has to be handled well. Would you agree with that?
It does indeed, because there's that old heresy in the second century of monotheism.
Yes.
That is very similar to the charismatic side of the church, but where it fell was it placed an emphasis on personal revelation above the teaching of the church.
Absolutely.
And I think that's when they're hand in
hand. You have done your homework. Gold stars for the congregation of St Anselm's.
So when they're hand in hand, they're brilliant. Mm. But I think a lot of people don't understand charismatic worship either. They think it's all about guitars and drums and
no, and it's not at all.
And it's not, but I think a lot of charismatic people think it is.
Mm.
But actually it's about
it's openness to the Holy Spirit,
which is the Catholic faith.
Yeah.
It's all these gifts of prophecy and tongues. That's all approved in the catechism. Mm. That's nothing weird.
Absolutely.
It's in the Bible. But it's within the context of the teaching of the magisterium.
It needs to be charged by word and sacrament and tested. And I think that's also actually where a trusted priesthood comes in, because I do think it can be a forum in which, if you're not careful, abuse can happen, where, you know, people may be opened up too much in the wrong setting. You know, that's when I've seen it go wrong, but actually more often I've seen it go right. And I have to say, I've always been struck by the integrity of and the personal holiness of people who love charismatic worship. And in fact, in our congregation, there's quite a group here, you may or may not know this, who are part of the local diocesan charismatic group. And it's interesting that they are both, you know, they love the charismatic worship, but they also love the tradition here at St Anselm.
Yes.
So again, that's knocking all the stereotypes, because we're an eastward facing, full of smoke on a Sunday. And yet, here there are a strand of people who pray for and with each other and really do like to explore that charismatic aspect and you know, all power to their elbow. Okay, you then go off to university. What was your Christian story at university?
So I think kind of coming from an evangelical background at HDB, you are naturally drawn to other evangelical churches, not necessarily Anglican churches. So I ended up at a kind of very free church, Anglican church. It's almost Pentecostal in that sense.
Mm.
Which was
hands in the air, brother.
Yes,
yeah, hands down for coffee. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So it was. We kind of met in the in a small kind of room at a gym.
Right.
It was that kind of
that sort of real house church. So now really, you're branching away from Anglicanism, which you just sort of held on to, into the free church, Pentecostal, charismatic realm. So there's a journey there, but actually at the moment in the opposite direction perhaps to where you end up. And I don't know about you, I always find in universities, certainly in my day, tell me if I'm wrong, but there used to be a Christian union that was almost always entirely evangelical and charismatic,
yes,
run from a nearby church and not officially going on at the college, and then the chaplaincy, which was always horribly liberal, not really doing anything spiritual,
yes,
and a bit of a dead place. And often, I mean, interesting, where I went at Homerton, they didn't even have a chaplaincy, but the Christian Union was there banging its tambourine. And it's really odd, that, isn't it, that in terms of university chaplaincy, so often what you end up with are academics who don't, you know, a bit in the sort of foggy, don't really believe much sense, when I'd send the polar opposite to young people. But anyway, that's me going off on a tangent. You tell me what it was like for you.
So I mean, it's similar, actually. I think there was a real hostility between the chaplaincy and the CU.
Yeah.
And they didn't really mix, and it was kind of expected, at least that's the impression I got from a lot of people who were above, you know, years above me, that actually they don't mix, and the college didn't want them to mix.
Interesting.
And we had a new chaplain in my second year. He was, he'd done part of his curacy at HTB.
Okay.
And he was a good friend of a lot of the kind of clergy I knew from HDB.
Okay, so there's a nice connection for you there.
And he wanted to do more stuff with him. And I was running the kind of CU at my college.
Okay.
Because the way it worked at Durham, it's probably similar in other Oxbridge colleges, is that you have a central CU and then you have college CUs, and then everyone meets up
together.
That's right. And we invited him and we wanted him to kind of give the kind of Advent, you know, sermon. And he was going to do it, and then all of a sudden he backed out. He wouldn't really tell us why, and I suspected that it was the kind of master kind of told him that didn't really fit with his.
Not going to happen here. No. Yeah, yeah. So that we live in Britain. We love the veneer of a religion, but the real thing mustn't be allowed out. Okay, so you're still running the CU here. You're still clearly heavily involved. You're loving God and really got a strong lay ministry there. Lots of notes to myself here. And that's fantastic stuff. So, look, hang on. Here's the obvious question. You're in Pentecostal worlds. You're just about hanging on to Anglicanism. Though interesting, I don't think very Anglican, more the Protestant.
Mm.
You're a young Protestant with a heart aflame for God. How on earth do you end up in St. Anselm's Pembury?
So, it was completely by accident. My brother had was sent to do his A-levels at Worth Abbey, which is a Benedictine school in Sussex.
Yeah, wonderful school.
And that was my first real introduction to the Catholic Church. I think up until that point, I had a very anti-Catholic attitude. Yes. Any kind of form of liturgy I frowned upon.
The Whore of Babylon.
Yes, absolutely. It was very...
It's drummed into evangelicals, isn't it? This suspicion of Catholicism. It's a hangover from Reformation days. And yet, interestingly, Nicky Gumbel of Holy Trinity Brompton, once he did Alpha, was invited to take it kind of on a bit of a roadshow. And I know when I met him at he came to Westcott House, and everyone was a little bit dismissive of him because they're all liberals and he was evangelical. And it won't surprise anyone that I went up to him and, understanding that world, tried to be very friendly to him. And he told me that, and I remember him telling me then, and I wasn't a Catholic, that he was really fascinated by Catholicism, that he'd gone along and actually a lot of his, I remember him telling me a lot of his preconceptions were proving false. So that's interesting.
Yes, and I think I don't know how I ended up with that attitude, because it wasn't something that was
drummed into
me at HDB. I think it was just simmering, I suppose. Yeah. And so ended up at Worth, my brother did, and so I kind of, you know, I went to watch the rugby there, and I went to family mass, and I went to Lourdes, and I think it was a moment in Lourdes.
Another Lourdes conversion. I hear a lot of them, right?
Yes, but this is Lourdes, obviously morning prayer, not the place, and because that often confuses people.
Oh, sorry. You mean Lourdes, as in terse Lourdes, matins. Okay, yes. Sorry.
Yeah. And so my brother was a prefect and had to go in his last year there.
Okay.
And so I was interested, so I kind of went along because my mother would drop him off and we would both go. And I saw a reverence and a piety from the monks when they were chanting the psalms. And I thought, they've got an actual faith and they believe it. And they believe it more than I do. And I thought, right, okay, there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to Durham, because this was on a weekend, and I decided to start going to Durham Cathedral. And so I kind of left my kind of Pentecostal...
Like Nicodemus church. At Mass, at night, you crept off to the Catholics, right.
And went to, and just absolutely, I went to Evensong, and just fell in love with the Book of Common Prayer.
So this is the Anglican cathedral at this point, right?
Yeah, so at Durham, which I was...
And it's such a wonderful cathedral as well, isn't it?
It's beautiful, and I didn't realise actually until yesterday that Durham used to be a Benedictine Abbey.
Yes, it did.
So there was that Benedictine
Oh, and you've
connection.
Got the relics of saints in there. Yeah.
Yes, Cuthbert and Bede.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so that I think that was the start of a journey.
Right. And so you then are now, having gone out of the Pentecostal world, you've kept hold of your charismatic love of God, and there's something in the formal Anglican liturgy that speaks to you,
yeah.
And yet, and Catholicism's intriguing you. How does it all come together?
So it's one of those things where it's the question kept bugging me. You know, what is Catholicism? What's the difference between Protestantism and Catholicism?
Mm-hmm.
And it would bug me. I'd think about it, and then I'd put it back in its box.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few months later, it would arise again. Until one day, I discovered Word on Fire on YouTube.
Yeah.
I'm not a YouTube guy at all, so I don't know how on earth I discovered that.
Mm.
And initially, I was very suspicious,
mm-hmm.
incredibly suspicious. Did not trust Bishop Barron at all. I thought you're a Catholic, so mm-hmm. I can't trust you.
Yeah.
Even if you're being, mm-hmm. you think
you sound
truth,
good. Yeah.
You sound good, but and so I fact checked everything he said, and I was just finding that actually he was telling the truth, and it was mm-hmm. the truth. And so I stopped fact checking after that,
mm-hmm.
and actually just started to read what he referenced. And so I read Newman's Apologia Pro Vita Sermon.
Oh, you know, that's the book that converted me.
I do know that.
I finished that and I had a moment, and it was nothing to do with the book. And I still get hairs on the back of my neck even when it's mentioned. Go on.
Oh, it was, and yeah. I think for me, and I think...
so beautifully written.
Yes, and I think with Newman, I think it was discovering the church fathers, actually, mm-hmm. kind of those that Oxford movement, kind of mm-hmm. getting into the fathers. And that's something I kind of obviously owe a lot to Bishop Barron for. Mm-hmm. Actually, I mean, I didn't even know who the fathers were. I had no clue, no
mm-hmm.
church history. I just thought that a group of people in the 90s at HDB had rediscovered the Holy Spirit, and everything had been dead since the time of
amazing,
the
isn't it? Yeah.
It's so ignorant, but no one had ever told me any different. So
sure.
Newman, and I think one of the things that Newman said is to be steeped in history is to cease to be Protestant.
Yes. Yeah, killer quote.
And so I think that shifted a lot for me. Mm-hmm. I read Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English
Oh,
people,
another wonderful book. Yeah.
And I discovered, oh,
well,
my
you're
goodness,
doing well. Yeah.
I discovered, oh, these Christians, that there are miracles going on. There's fire coming down from heaven.
Mm.
There's all of this. It's like, oh, that's not just something that I have. That,
yeah, you know, the HDB didn't church. Invented this. Yeah.
Exactly. And so their faith was real.
Mm.
And so a link back to HDB, really, I have a friend at HDB who I didn't know was Catholic. He went to Mass on a Sunday, every Sunday, and then he would come to HDB in the evening.
Looking for a girlfriend. Yeah.
Probably. Yeah, we had a great youth group.
Yeah.
And but I vaguely remember him mentioning that he wouldn't come to Soul Survivor with us because he was going to kind of Catholic Youth Day, which I didn't know what that was. And so we never really talked about it. And so I got in touch with him and just said, just explain what was going on. And obviously he was delighted. So we went for a walk and he kind of got me the UCAT.
Yeah, great little book.
So we discussed a few things.
So UCAT is a youth catechism produced by the Catholic Truth Society. It's a great gift to give anyone exploring the faith because it's got a very easy to read question and answer style, but actually the whole faith's in there, isn't it? It's a good book.
Absolutely, it's brilliant. It's very simple. But so I was 23 at the time.
Okay.
And I was doing my master's in law, so I had it's fair to say I had quite a lot of time on my hands.
Mm-hmm.
So he encouraged me just to get in touch with my local and a parish priest,
mm-hmm.
And at the time that was Father Tesfer Michael
in
Corpus Christi.
Corpus Christi,
who's,
Tunbridge.
He's no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely Eritrean man.
Nice man, yeah.
And yeah, he was very helpful. I mean, I'd come in at a kind of slightly odd time.
Mm-hmm. With the pandemic, this would be.
With the pandemic, it was, and I did take a few months to get in contact with him, to be honest, mm-hmm. but I wonder whether it's because he was from mean, he grew up in a country where they had an Eastern liturgy and wasn't yes. necessarily so institutionalized in the kind of Roman rite, that actually he was willing just to, you know, say, come and have a coffee, even though the pandemic was kind of
going on, just kind of let me
crack on. Mm. So that was helpful. Yeah, really, really helpful. And we met every week, and I was reading a lot, and he would.
Oh, God bless. Comments. God bless Father. Yeah,
absolutely.
And so then you are worshipping now then just down the road at Corpus Christi Tunbridge. What brought you to St Anselm's?
Well, it was the fact that there was no evening Ash Wednesday services. This is my first. Okay. Kind of Ash Wednesday in the Catholic.
So have you just
Catholic
done
church.
Your first year? Yeah.
I've been a Catholic 18 months now. So I was confirmed in.
I mentioned St Anselm's. A year at St Anselm's roughly. Yeah.
Yeah, as in from when I first arrived. Yes, but I didn't kind of come back until I think September. But it was because of that. So I was working at Cripps. This is before I was given the training contract, and I decided to. We'll walk from there to here. It took me an hour.
Yeah, it would do.
And I was very, very intrigued. I didn't really know much about the Ordinariate at that point. But what I discovered here was this very, I think, very solemn worship. It did feel heavenly. I would say that. Yeah. I think the way the Mass was celebrated was. And I just with all the incense and just
an awe and reverence is what I hope we try and instill.
And that's what drew me to the Catholic Church. Yeah. So I think kind of seeing more of that was very helpful. But at that point, I was very much I was going to Corpus Christi, and I kind of made my kind of home there. So I didn't think of moving until I wondered whether my mother would want to come along, particularly coming from an Anglo kind of Catholic background, that she might find it more palatable.
Right, so you thought it would be a good place for her to experience. And I mean, that's the interesting thing with becoming Catholic, isn't it? Someone said to me that Anglicans go to church, Catholics go to Mass. And it's so true. As an Anglican, you know, to go to another church down the road is almost... A breaking and a rebellion, you know. Oh, what do you mean you've gone to another church? Because they're almost sort of fiercely competitive. But in the Catholic Church, you know, a lot of people who worship here go to several churches because we're one church. We do have that unity. And of course, in the Anglican Church, you can't just do that because the church down the road will be teaching something completely different. Yeah. And yet, as Catholics, even if the liturgy can be incredibly different, the actual faith is the same. So. People do hop around the churches in the deanery. I think that's a positive thing. Mm. Okay, so you've bought Mum St Anselm, thinking, well, maybe it'll just be useful to her, given her Anglican past. Back to you.
Yeah, and then I discovered that I really liked it as well.
Okay.
And I think the thing that struck me is, that particularly coming from an evangelical background, I think the fervency of the preaching.
I knew you were going to say that.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's this kind of. I think what comes across, I think particularly from you and Father Nick, is this real love for Jesus. It radiates, and you know what you believe, and it just feels solid.
I think there is a confidence in the preaching of a lot of ordinariate priests. That's something of our patrimony. The interesting thing, I've had other Catholics will say, I once went and covered at a church and a man came up afterwards. He went, "You're an ex-Anglican." I said, "How did you know?" And he said, "Because of your sermon." He said, "You preach differently." I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's interesting. I knew you'd say that. But of course, I am ex-evangelical, so I probably do have a little bit of an evangelical zeal to my preaching. But well, good to hear it. Some people like it. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think particularly if you walk in off the street as well, and you're completely unchurched, I think it's very relatable.
It's quite direct.
It's very direct. Mm-hmm. But I think there is a fervency, and you know, you do see this in other Catholic churches. But I think sometimes, sadly, you do see in some Catholic churches it's this kind of I'm going to shut my eyes, I'm going to cover my ears and actually...
A bit apologetic almost, yeah.
Yes, and we're just going to have a holy huddle and the world is actually burning outside and actually we need to step it up and work out what we really believe.
We need to get going, yeah.
And be, Christian 7 days a week and actually witness to our faith. And that's I think, coming here. I do leave here every Sunday or every Mass in the week, actually wanting to go and tell people about Jesus.
Yeah, praise God.
Even though I'm kind of not very good at it.
No, well, none of us are, but we have to do it somehow. Well, that's fantastic. So recently you joined the Ordinariate, didn't you? So you're now a member of it. And what are your hopes maybe for the Ordinariate into the future and for the Catholic Church and for yourself?
I think it makes evangelization easier, particularly for kind of evangelicals.
I'm going to put you in touch, I think, with Monsignor Nasser Ali, because he came from the evangelical world, and he's at the moment, you won't know this, but at the moment he's pulling together a group to try and reach out specifically to the evangelical world. And I think you might be a great person for him, but anyway, that's an aside. Yeah, I think that's true. I think, and it's interesting that the Ordinariate does seem to be not attracting the sort of gin and lace brigade of the Anglo-Catholic world. I think the Anglo-Catholics who were going to come have come. Actually, it does seem to be either country parsons who really took the creed seriously or evangelicals who are increasingly interested.
Yes, and I know a lot of Anglican clergy, you do have a devout faith. You have privately said to me, you know, sometimes I would rather be a kind of Catholic priest, and I think that step is a lot easier coming into the Ordinariate. And I suppose just to clarify, when I say evangelization of evangelicals, I don't mean bringing them to Christ. I just mean catechesis and bringing them into full communion,
filling in their gaps, which means getting them onto the bark of Peter.
Exactly, and that's my story.
Have you come across Steve Ray?
Yes,
Ray is a fabulous ex-Baptist, for listeners, who became a Catholic by reading the Bible. It's the most extraordinary. You must go on YouTube and listen to his conversion story. And the more he read the Bible, the more he realised it spoke of the Catholic Church. And he became a Catholic. He's a fabulous guy. But he recently spoke about the fact that the Catholic Church is like a great ship, and really he sees Protestants as on rafts, and it's the job of getting them from the life raft onto the ship. I thought it was a rather nice little image.
It's a very wonderful, wonderful image. And for those who kind of are from nominal Anglican backgrounds, or their parents or their grandparents, I think it's the Ordinariate is very useful to the Catholic Church. I think it's a great olive branch that Pope Benedict has extended to England, not just the church, but to England. And I think one of the wonderful things is that actually appealing to tradition, actually, you know, your grandfather was a Christian, your great grandfather was a Christian, and I think it's one of the things.
And these were the prayers they would have said.
These are the prayers they would have said.
So it's bringing that English patrimony back, that spirituality lost at the Reformation, and then retained in the Church of England, but it was kind of rudderless. I always say it was, you know, praying the old English missal as I did as an Anglo-Catholic, which had the prayer book language. You know, when we became Catholic, it suddenly felt like we'd put bullets into the gum. We were no longer firing blanks. This was now charge when we were speaking of the body and blood of Christ. And I just think it's come back home. You know, the liturgy has come back home, back to its old rites. There was the old Sarum rite, you know, the old English rites, that English way coming home to Peter.
Yeah, and I think for Catholics who are slightly just suspicious of it, it's actually important to know that, you know, it was the Book of Common Prayer was translated from the Sarum Rite.
Exactly.
It was only translated in the last 2 years of Henry VIII's reign. And obviously it was changed. And obviously that's why the Vatican did have to purge it from its
Protestant roots. Of course. Well, nothing comes from a vacuum. And this is what people forget. So, you know, the Book of Common Prayer that the Anglicans used, as you say, didn't drop from the sky the minute they became Protestant. It came forth from the English Sarum Catholic rite. And the truth is, so many things that were Catholic went into the new body. That was the great tragedy, and we lost them. And it's about bringing those home. And it's a bit like the Bible itself. And I now always tease evangelicals who say, you know, you just need the Bible. I say, well, where did you get your Bible from? Exactly. Who decided which books went in?
Exactly.
Oh, would that be a council of the Catholic Church? And then they go a bit, shuffle their feet, look at their, and say, oh, well, it's changed since then. But it is that point, isn't it?
It very much is. I mean, I like what... I kind of slightly changed what James I says when he said to the Puritans, no bishop, no king. Mm. I changed it to kind of no bishop, no Bible. I mean, that literally, that is, the Catholic Church established the canon. And I think I knew that while I was at HTB, but I was told that. But what I wasn't told that it didn't have 66 books in it.
You don't connect the dots, though, do you? I remember as an evangelical, you knew these things. You know, I still remember going into my father's lovely old Norfolk churches, and they'd have those boards with clergy names.
Mm.
And it would go all the way back to the Doomsday Book.
Yes, exactly.
And there was this list of clergy names. And I knew then that if you went before the Reformation, that those were Catholic priests, and the ones after were Anglican priests. But no one draws a line and says this is an entirely separate ecclesial body. No one points out this was a moment of rupture. And that actually this notion of continuity back, it's a fantasy. Actually, the true church was suppressed and a new one erected. And I kind of knew it, but I didn't really think through all those implications, because until you have a Catholic head, you're just looking at it from all the wrong angles.
Yeah, it's completely true. I mean, that's a funny that you share that story, because I had a similar situation a year ago, nearly exactly a year ago, at my grandfather's funeral in the kind of church I mentioned, All Saints Harbury, where you've got that board, and it's you know, it goes back to the 12th century,
and it's a lie.
It is a lie. And I said to you after the funeral, I said to my uncle's best friend, who is Catholic, I said, and these are all the Catholic priests, and these are all the Anglican priests, and he laughed, because it's true.
It's true. We need tipex and rulers. We should go around. Catholics should go around with tipex and just draw a line. That's all you need to do. I mean, there's some truth to it, but it's not the full truth. And it's always when they say, you know, Archbishop Welby, the 100-and-something successor to Augustine. I go, no, the 40-odd successor since Cranmer.
Yes.
And that's the truth. But it's that glossing over the Reformation and what it meant, and trying to pretend, as the Church of England does, that it retains that which it cut itself off from. It wants to have its cake and eat it, doesn't it? We're Protestant, and yet we retain all the Catholicity and the... and the links, but it's just not true. And I mean, I always say to people, they say, oh, no, but we were, you know, the successors. And I say, well, then why did Henry VIII throw St. Augustine's bones to the dogs? And he did it to make clear this was new. So, I mean, what a messy old history. You don't want to rake all that up. But I think it is important to say, for the purpose of what we are, that the ordinariate can bring back into a true unity the modern Anglican realm with actually that which went before the Reformation, and that's the gift of the Catholic Church, to bring home an authentic English spirituality and history.
Absolutely. And I think just to add, Bishop Barron's mentor, Cardinal Francis George, would always say that, you know, that
I loved him,
and he would say that the Catholic Church has all the gifts that God has given to his church, but it doesn't mean that other denominations don't exercise them better.
Absolutely.
And so even post Cranmer, that you know, the kind of it is undeniable to say that kind of God wrote through men and women wonderful hymns and wonderful music, and we need to take all of that.
God is very generous, and you know, after the Reformation, there is not the fullness of truth in the Church of England, but there are aspects of it. And it's a bit like my own ministry. I can tell you that as a Church of England minister, I wasn't a priest, I was a minister. Mm. That'll upset some people, but it's true. You know, I prayed and anointed people who got better.
Mm.
So a bit like your mum's book, I could write you a book of prayers that were answered. And they were answered because, I mean, in the words of the Catholic Mass itself, we were seeking him with a sincere heart.
Mm.
And God always responds to us seeking him with a sincere heart. So look, other denominations, of course they have blessings from God, and of course they do things. And as I said earlier, I was commending the evangelicals on their sincerity and love of God. So that isn't to dismiss it. And yet they don't have that fullness of truth. And of course, they don't have that authority, which is why they're now in a hopeless mess. And I think there is a great danger. I think, you know, I don't understand now, given the recent decisions of the Church of England, how evangelicals will be able to remain in good conscience. Other than that, they often just say, well, I'm fishing from the best boat. You know, but it's going to be a difficult time for them. And I do hope we could bring so many of the gifts they offer actually into the Catholic Church, because it strikes me they have an awful lot of what Catholics need, actually. Can you imagine letting loose a Sandy Miller and a Nicky Gumbel and an HTB Zeal into the average Catholic parish?
I think it would be mental. It's that kind of supercharging.
Yeah.
And I do think that there is because of that sincerity of faith. I think those who are the faithful within the Church of England, I do take great comfort in the fact that, you know, one of the things that Father Stephen Wang, who's now
lovely man,
rector,
yeah. he helped prepare us priests and bring us in.
Oh yeah, and his Sycamore series is fantastic. I commend that to anyone. He said that, you know, if you're seeking Jesus with all your heart, you will be led to the Catholic Church. And I think just bringing it back to my teenage years, when I was 14, I did have that stage of doubt. Mm-hmm. I really, really did. And I went away on a HTB youth weekend, and I said, God, if you're real, you've got to show me. Mm. And You've got to.
God said, oh, really?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, God could have said, no, don't be so arrogant, but... And I probably was, but he did bless me. And actually,
you were 14 and a male at an English good school. Of course, you were arrogant. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. At the Judd School, yeah. Who was told we are the top 5% of the country in intelligence? Yeah. So it was drummed into us. But no, I was being prayed for in St Paul's Onslow Square, which is one of the HDB churches. And suddenly everything, my eyes closed, and suddenly everything went white. And I could see, as far as the eye could see, I could see angels, legions and legions of angels.
Wow.
And I knew you
had a vision. Yeah.
Yes, I did. I knew I was in the body.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was in the church, but it was like I was there.
But I understand. I've had visions, so I completely understand, yeah.
And it's a wonderful grace to be given. And I saw the front of this army of angels, I saw Christ, and I knew it was Jesus. I don't know how I knew it was Jesus, but I knew it was Jesus. I knew him. And as I got closer and closer and closer, he began to speak to me. And I don't need to say what he said, but I ended up just completely falling over, as you would do if you get if you get closer to Jesus. And that was a bit of a shock. And then 2 weeks later, the same thing happened. I was on another kind of a retreat with another organisation called the Stewards Trust, which is linked to HDB. And the same thing happened, but it happened very quickly. Suddenly Jesus was right in front of me. I could, like, literally within a foot, and he spoke to me, and I fell flat on my face, just like Joshua. And I couldn't doubt after that.
No, you knew.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful.
You've
been touched, so yeah.
But I think that's the thing, is once you know Jesus and you love Jesus, you keep seeking after the truth.
Yes.
And you won't stop until you find it. And
you may fall for a bit, but you always come back.
I found it in the Catholic Church.
God's got hold of you, no doubt. You clearly have something to do for him, so that's exciting for the future. Finally, I'm going to ask... It's so wonderful to have someone in their mid-20s in our congregation. I mean, we're a congregation, we have, you know, last Sunday I think we had over 30 children between 0 and 18, wonderful. Which is, praise God. We have people who are old, people who are middle-aged, a lot of people in their 30s and 40s. But actually I'd say the 20s, we've got a few, we've got four or five, but not that many. No. And I think in churches across Britain, they're the most... You know, it's between 18 and 30 is probably the period you're least likely to be in church. And part of that's because they're out living their life. You've not had your own kids and then you come back to it. But why do you think your generation are just not in church these days?
Well, I think probably I'd say, I mean, there are lots of things, but I'd say two main things. I think one of them is just the spirit of the age.
Agreed. People want to fit in, and we are so untrendy, it's unbelievable.
Yes, I think that there's a lot of that. I think there's been a narrative of kind of the church is anti-science, that there's, you know, that God is dead, and that's
just all come from the media, of course.
Yeah. Yes, of course, and that's all just come from a, you know, and that's filtered through the home, and after generations, people fall away.
Yeah,
I think the other thing is that I think people are not, we don't tell people. It's not. Yeah. And I think if our faith is genuine,
and faith not practiced in the home is a huge one, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think Augustine described parents as pastors in their own home, and I think that's
lovely.
And that's
what
just,
a phrase.
Yeah, and I just think that is essential, and that's something I'm very grateful for. But I think most people haven't had that. But I do wonder whether, you know, a lot of it is it doesn't come across, particularly for young men, it's not genuine.
Yeah.
And I think in the Catholic Church, I think there is a propensity to dumb things down.
Yeah, it doesn't help them. It
doesn't help men because it's
no, and it's naff. It's often embarrassing as well. It's tacky and embarrassing, and it's wet, and it's asking them to be limp. And yeah, I agree with you.
And I mean, I took one of my friends when I was at university, and this probably signifies my two points. So there's two friends with different perspectives. So one of them I took to the kind of Pentecostal church, and I think he just thought it was all a bit silly. He just thought it was silly. And actually, all of my friends at Durham, they were very much drawn to the traditional side of church, but they just didn't believe it. But when I took them there, they did, or at least he did. And not to say that you can't take your friends to an evangelical church and they can't find Jesus. Of course they can. My brother's doing that at the moment, and it's going well. But we did some baptisms in the river at the time. He just thought it was all a bit silly. The whole thing was silly. And I just hope that hasn't done too much damage. But I have another friend who I engage with on a more intellectual level. And he got to the stage where he was like, okay, I believe in God. I believe the Bible is true. But I'm not prepared to live the moral life. And that is the spirit of the age.
Yes.
And I thought that's very scary.
So much. And in so many of the debates with the whole LGBT issue in the Church of England, everything really behind a lot of the narrative of people saying, I am no longer willing to believe God will give me grace not to exercise my sexual life. You know, they don't want to. And of course, at that point, it's doomed. So it's interesting. I think that is very true. And I think there are a lot of people want to live a life that doesn't fit the Christian narrative. So we've got to show them that actually it's a better life. If you do manage by God's grace to live the Catholic faith, you will be free and you will be joyful. Well, I think that's a great place to end. James, thank you so much for that. We wish you so well in the rest of your final training as you come to be a lawyer. Do you have any final thoughts or messages? That's put you on the spot.
It has. I would just say, just keep going with God.
That's a great thing to do.
Just keep going with God, because he'll never let you down, and you just got to keep pushing through, because he hasn't let me down yet.
Yeah, never give up. Which is a good, that's same in marriage or anything else.
Yeah.
Just keep going. Well, on that note, we'll leave you. Thank you all, and God bless.
Well, there, what a fascinating journey to the Catholic Church James Shagaghi has had in what is really just a short life thus far. I think he has a great deal to offer the Church and to God as he follows his vocation in life. Well, that's it for this week. We're coming up for that hour mark. Next week I'll be back with another interview, and this time I'm going to be interviewing our very own assistant priest, Father Nicholas Levasseur, a genuine eccentric. I think it will be an episode not to be missed. I'll make sure to ask him everything that will get him into trouble somewhere. God bless, take care, and see you next time.
Clemens rectore te.